Can't sleep? Don't want to sleep? Afraid to sleep? Are the windows closed? Are your doors locked? Did you check your closet? And under your bed? Maybe you should keep a light on in the hallway, just in case. Now settle in. Make yourself comfortable. Lay back, close your eyes, and let me tell you a story.
Arriving January 9th and available for pre-order now, The Reality Reaction Team, a brand new mind-bending sci-fi cyberpunk thriller by author Joe Prosit. In the distant future, humanity spends its time dancing through layers of simulated universes inside of simulated universes, while the real world crumbles around them. The powers that be offer a simple solution. Take the long nap and enter a decade-long hibernation while a select few rebuild Earth into a utopia. Two young lovers, Josh, a hallucinating lowlife, and Ziggy, a university student determined to quantify objective truth, find themselves caught in a spiraling tangle of conspiracy, illusion, and worlds within worlds as they begin to decipher the sinister facade of the long nap and find important allies in a mysterious group called the Reality Reaction Team. Pre-order your ebook or paperback now at joeprosit.com.
People often say they are struck by Cupid's arrow when they fall in love at first sight. The truth is, much of how our brains process emotions like love and hate is still a mystery. For example, what causes us to hate someone whom we were once passionately in love with? Is the line between love and hate so thin, so fragile, that all it takes is a little push to move from one to the other? The Love Bee.
"Geez, what happened to you?" I asked Captain Bodhi. She looked up at me, the lower left corner of her mouth swollen and red, like she got hit by a golf ball. "I warned you about walking by the driving range."
"Beef thing," she replied, as if her tongue was twice as large as it was supposed to be. "Is there something I can do for you, Detective Roman, besides listen to your corny jokes?"
I stared at her puffy lower lip for a moment before remembering why I had come into her office. "Yeah, this interrogation you want me to do. Why do I always get the crazies?"
She rifled through some file folders on her desk in an obvious attempt to show she was too busy for my annoying question. "Because, Roman, you're good with them. For some reason they like you. They probably sense the kindred spirit."
I rolled my eyes at her offhanded compliment.
"Just take her statement and hand it over to the DA. They'll either cut her loose or lock her in the psych ward."
"Why bother? Do you actually think she killed millions of people?" The captain shrugged and waved me off. I left her office and wound my way through the desks of the bullpen to the interrogation rooms and entered one of the adjacent observation chambers. I watched through the two-way mirror for a minute, sizing up my assignment. The self-proclaimed mass murderer was sitting at the steel table, her hands wrapped around a styrofoam cup, half filled with black coffee. She wasn't your typical homicidal maniac. Despite her gray hair, I judged her to be middle-aged, with wrinkles just starting to crease the corners of her eyes and mouth. She wore a t-shirt from a local theme park with the phrase "Coaster Girl" in bright, rounded lettering. Her blue jeans were crisp and new, but her sneakers were well-worn and dingy. One foot tapped nervously against the tile floor as she sipped at the coffee, her eyes darting between the door, the mirror, and the camera mounted in one corner. I opened the door between the two rooms, took a seat opposite her, and laid a pad and pen on the table. She looked up at me with a look of despair in her eyes. "My name's Detective Roman. I understand you want to make a statement."
"I've already spoken to half a dozen people."
"I know, but I need to hear it from you directly. It's not often we get a Stalin-level mass murderer in here. Let's start with your name." I picked up the pen, ready to jot down my notes. She sighed and sat back in her chair.
Dr. Jessica Moraine.
You're a physician?
I have an MD, yes, but I also have a PhD in biology.
I scribbled her name on my pad. Are you married?
What does that have to do with anything?
Just trying to get the whole picture.
No, I'm divorced. No children. But I have 2 brothers, 3 nieces, and 2 nephews. My parents are deceased, and I live in a 1-bedroom apartment just off campus.
You work at the university?
Yes, primarily research, but I teach a little as well.
I paused to jot a few words on my pad. Doctor, divorced, research.
Listen, are we going to keep on playing This Is Your Life, or do you even care about what I have to say?
You mean the part about you killing millions of people? Because, to be honest with you, I just checked before I came in here. And as far as I can tell, there are not countless corpses in the streets.
There will be, very soon.
And how are you going to do that if you're in here?
It's already done. You just don't know it yet.
Her words hung in the air between us. As a detective, you get pretty good at reading people. At being able to tell when someone is lying or hiding something, or just plain crazy. Dr. Jessica Moraine was terrified. What did you do? I asked.
I didn't stop them. I could have come forward publicly, been a whistleblower, warned people.
Warned them about what?
The Love Bee.
The Love Bee? Any relation to Herbie the Love Bug? She grimaced. My jokes weren't everyone's cup of tea.
Basically, it's a biological Cupid's arrow.
I leaned forward, pen in hand, but I didn't know exactly what to write down. I'm not following.
My research involved the enhancement of hormonally induced sensitivity to pheromonal attraction via a virus using insect venom as a vector of transmission.
I regarded her with a look I hope conveyed my ongoing frustration. Pretend I don't have a PhD in biology.
I was trying to create a bee that, when it stung you, caused you to fall in love.
I dropped my pen. Why?
It started off as an intellectual exercise, a way to put a potential scientific explanation to the myths. But then I thought it just might be what the world needs.
What's wrong with the old-fashioned way of falling in love? Getting drunk over a few beers and going back to her place. She almost laughed at that joke.
Have you spent more than 5 minutes online these days? Watched the news? The debates in Congress? The bottom line, I guess, is I was hoping to make this a better world.
But? There's always a but when someone thinks what they're doing will make the world a better place.
But,
she began, then shook her head as if it was suddenly filled with bad memories.
I should have known what the but was when Quantum Pharmaceutical offered to fund the project. They got wind of a paper I wrote describing the biological mechanisms that could make a love bee possible, and they threw a ton of money at my department and the university to make it a reality.
Wasn't the CEO of Quantum Pharmaceutical assassinated a while back? I asked.
That was a different guy. The one who took over from him was trying to portray a kindler and gentler corporate image. The Love Bee was the perfect project to remedy the missteps of his predecessor.
Sounds like a good thing for you. All unicorns and rainbows. Where does the ominous but come in?
But,
she continued,
they weren't in it for the unicorns and rainbows. Even though Quantum Pharmaceutical was fronting the funding, most of it was actually coming from quantum defense systems.
Why?
Why else? They thought they could turn it into a weapon.
Okay, I may just be a dumb homicide detective, but how could falling in love with someone be weaponized?
I can think of 100 ways,
she stated casually.
Infect the leader of a country, cause him to have an affair, and create instability in his marriage. Render an entire military brigade effectively useless because they'd rather make love than war. Foolproof honey traps for espionage.
Okay, you don't have to list all 100. But It does sound better than blowing people up.
That's what my department head, Dr. Alexander French, thought as well. He recruited other faculty and graduate students to help bring my theories to life.
Alexander French, I mused. Why does that name sound familiar?
He killed his wife last week.
Ah, I remembered hearing about the case, though I wasn't personally involved.
Mrs. French was the first victim.
And the last. French confessed. He'll be locked away for a good long time. The doctor shook her head as if I had completely missed her point. I steered the conversation back on course. So, did you actually create this love bee?
We did,
she confessed despondently.
I tried to emphasize the necessity of strict lab protocols and that we should be implementing BSL-4.
What's that?
Biosafety Level 4, what we use for things like Ebola and anthrax.
Seems a little bit of overkill for a love potion. She sat forward and stared straight into my eyes.
We were creating things that didn't exist in nature. We were tinkering with the biology of three different species, the virus, the bees, and human beings. It's not something to be taken lightly. And unfortunately, I was proven right.
What do you mean?
There was a lab leak. You see, the way it was supposed to work is that we modified a virus that was endemic to bees to also infect humans. It took quite a bit of genetic manipulation, but we managed to create one that once it infected humanized mice, would replicate and cause the animal to manufacture a specific hormone that increased pheromonal sensitivity.
I raised an eyebrow, reminding her I wasn't a scientist.
It made the mice horny.
Ah, gotcha.
Anyway, we isolated the virus and only infected a single bee at a time so we could see how long it would take the virus to spread to its venom. Once the tests were done, the bee was incinerated.
Poor bee.
The protocol specified that the bee's wings be removed before it was infected and its stinger coated with an epoxy resin.
So it couldn't fly away and sting someone.
Precisely. But one of the graduate students, who was responsible for wrangling the bees, thought it was cruel, and instead returned the bees to the colony, infecting the entire hive. She was also uncomfortable removing the wings, so she would put one of the bees' legs in a tiny clamp instead. One of them got loose by pulling off its own leg and stung her.
Wasn't the stinger epoxied?
If so, obviously not very well. And to make matters worse, she didn't report the incident.
Well, how did you find out?
The next day, she arrived dressed rather provocatively. Her hair was down, she was wearing makeup and flirting with every man in the lab.
So it worked?
Yes, only no one realized what was actually happening until it spread to half the staff.
But how? I thought you had to be stung by a bee. And as I recall from my childhood experiences, once a bee stings you, the stinger comes off and it dies.
After a host is infected, it can be transmitted sexually.
I realized what she was getting at. And your horny little grad student became the Typhoid Mary of love.
In a manner of speaking.
So, not that bad. I mean, realistically, how many people could she infect that way?
Enough to create an extremely distracting working environment. Eventually, someone was careless with the bee colony, and we lost containment.
The infected bees got away? She nodded. But they mostly keep to themselves, right? I mean, bees don't normally go looking for people to sting.
Yes, that's true of your typical honeybee. But the geniuses from Quantum decided it would be more effective to use Africanized honeybees.
Killer bees? She nodded again.
They wanted to make sure that the virus would spread as fast as possible through the primary vector.
Okay, so lots of people are probably infected by now. What's the downside, aside from a lot of unplanned pregnancies?
The mice,
she replied. The mice?
The humanized mice that had been infected with the virus.
The horny mice?
Yes. You see, love is one half of a double-sided coin.
The other half being?
Hate. The mice started getting aggressive, violent. They would get into mortal battles.
Why?
The virus doesn't have an off switch. It just keeps on causing the production of the hormone. And it's very good at hiding from the immune system. You basically get an overdose.
You're telling me these mice loved each other to death? She smirked.
You certainly have a way with words, Detective Roman, but yes.
Then it hit me. You think Dr. French was infected?
Either he was stung, or more likely, that graduate student seduced him. I can only imagine that he went through something similar to the mice. His affection intensified until it became aggression, probably an irrational jealousy.
Puts new meaning to a crime of passion, I joked. She shrugged.
Who knows? This is a completely novel virus. We were just starting to explore the consequences of what we were trying to do when we lost control.
Okay, but why do you think this will affect millions of people in such a negative way? Has anyone else in your lab gone homicidal?
No.
I breathed a sigh of relief.
Not yet. But they are all much younger than Dr. French. It's possible it may take a while longer to manifest in them. It could take some people days, while others may turn violent in hours. And the love bees have been loose for weeks.
But you don't know for sure. Like you said, this is a novel virus. It could mutate into something completely harmless.
Yes, that's possible,
she replied unconvincingly. But you still believe that millions of people will die?
Probably hundreds of millions from the virus. Billions more from the subsequent societal breakdown.
Still, it's just guesswork on your part.
As a police officer, you must be aware of the increased incidence of public lewdness. It's becoming a running joke on the nightly news.
I had indeed heard the beat cops and vice squad complaining about how busy they were dealing with, to put it mildly, overly affectionate couples.
It won't be long before that amorous behavior turns to violence and death.
I shook my head, not wanting to buy into her doomsday scenario. The French murder was a week ago. Certainly we would have seen more incidents like that by now.
You will. Like I said, Dr. French was likely more susceptible because of his age, but the infection will overwhelm the younger population soon.
As if to punctuate her prediction, a shot rang out. I instinctively reached for my holster, but my gun was safely locked in my desk drawer. It's not a good idea to have a firearm with you when you're interviewing a self-identified mass murderer. There were more shots, followed by screams and shouts. I looked at Dr. Moraine, still unwilling to believe what she had told me was true. There had to be another explanation for the chaos erupting outside the interrogation room. I rose to my feet.
I'm sorry,
she said. Looking away, she emptied the dregs from her coffee cup. I exited into the hallway. A thin haze of smoke crept around the corner. I cautiously made my way back toward the bullpen. As I got closer, I could see bodies lying on the floor. A woman cried in the corner. Men and women wrestled each other on the floor, fighting for control of sidearms or simply trying to choke each other. I slowly wound my way through the desks toward my own to retrieve my gun.
Walter, is that you?
A woman's voice asked. It was Captain Bodie. She looked different. Her hair was down, blouse unbuttoned beyond her normal professional style, and she wore lipstick, which unflatteringly accentuated her distorted, bee-stung lips. She lunged toward me, wrapping her arms around my neck and holding me tight. It's okay, Captain, I told her. But I knew instantly from the way she was acting that everything Dr. Moraine had told me was true.
Call me Kathy, Walter. You know, I've always had a thing for you, but I've been afraid to say anything.
She pulled back and started kissing my face, eventually zeroing in on my lips. Hers felt strange against my skin, swollen and taut. I tried to push her away, but the look in her eyes was intense, ravenous.
I'm so glad you're okay,
she said.
I was so worried something had happened to you. I don't know what I would do if you were dead.
Captain, get a hold of yourself.
I love you so much, Walter,
she said. kissing me hard. "Kathy," I said when I could catch a breath, "we have to get out of here. I need to get my gun." I managed to drag myself, the captain clinging to me, toward my desk. I fumbled for my keys and unlocked the drawer. Captain Bodie kept glomming onto me like a mouse stuck in a sticky trap. "Let's go. We have to get someplace safe." I managed to push her ahead of me back toward the hallway that led to the evidence room. The hallway was littered with bodies. Some of the fallen were still breathing, moaning in pain.
"Are you trying to get rid of me?"
she asked. "I'm trying to save you. That bee sting, it's done something to you. You're not yourself."
"Don't go, Walter. I love you."
I pushed her into the evidence room. "Close the door. Don't come out until I come back."
"You're leaving me?"
Her tone grew angry. "I'll be back as soon as I can," I reassured her as I checked to make sure my gun was loaded and ready to fire. The captain drew her own sidearm.
"I won't be ignored," she insisted.
I tried my best to look at her longingly, hoping to play into her hormonal delusion. "Kathy, it's okay. I love you too. I promise, we'll be together. I just need to get help."
"You're a liar,"
she screamed. The muzzle flashed a fraction of a second before I heard the shot and felt a bullet punch into my chest. Then, the captain put the barrel of the gun into her mouth and fired again. The world started getting fuzzy, and I found it more difficult to breathe. But I managed to stumble toward the exit and make it outside. It was chaos. Cars burned, people chased one another down the street, and those that weren't amorously engaged were trying to kill each other. A bee approached me, buzzing as it landed on my hand. I swatted it and felt its stinger prick the skin between my thumb and forefinger. Dr. Moraine approached and steadied me as I started to collapse. She gently lowered me to the ground and inspected my gunshot wound. I could tell from the look on her face that it was as bad as it felt.
"I'm sorry, Detective Roman,"
she said as she picked up the now lifeless bee that had stung me, inspecting it closely. Then she looked down at me with a look of sorrow and regret. "I think I love you," I said, with my last breath. She smiled, laughing at my final joke, as the world faded to black.
Thank you for listening to The Love Bee, written especially for the Bedtime Stories for Insomniacs fiction podcast by Rich Hosek. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast platform. But most importantly, please share these stories with anyone you know who enjoys audiobooks. If you sign up for the Insomniacs newsletter at bedtimestories.studio, you will receive a free audio or ebook edition of The Charlatan's Conundrum and other bedtime stories for insomniacs. You can find out more about the host of Bedtime Stories for Insomniacs at richhosek.com. Thanks again, and all the very best.
The Luke in Time Mysteries begins with two private detectives. Luke, who's got a little bit of a drinking problem, and her partner Lyle, who's got a little bit of an eating problem. Together, they've got pretty big money problem. So when Marva walks into their office, offering gobs of cash, if they can find someone who's trying to kill her, they take the job without asking any question, which becomes their biggest problem, because soon enough, they walk into a trap and wind up dead. But that's not where this story ends. In fact, it's just the setup, because they go back to the moment where they first met Marva, and until Luke and Lyle can solve Marva's mystery, they keep dying over and over again. If this book sounds like something you'd enjoy, check the links in the show notes to learn more.
You can find out more about the nine lives of Marva DeLonghi and the Luke and Time Mysteries at jodyjsperling.com.